Good morning. I've been looking forward to this for ages, and I hope you have. I was here. Wow, it's loud, but good. I was here for 7 years, and we left 3 years ago, and I particularly bring greetings from Izan, my wife, who, as we speak, is attempting to capture the hearts and minds of a whole bunch of three-year-olds with the story of the Nativity. So imagine that. I think this is probably the easiest straw to have drawn. And it's always great to be here, not least because there's always more babies as I come. I mean, these are babies born to people when I first knew them. They were single, and I thought they had very little hope of ever getting married. And without mentioning any names, you know, Dom, Paul, and Hugh, it's amazing to see how far they've come. So, you know, take hope, guys. There's hope for all of us. Just in a nutshell, I help to lead a church the other side of town in a place called Longwell Green, and things are going well in the sense that we're seeing God really at work. Last Sunday night, we had three young people and an older person baptized in our church, and it was absolutely crammed full of people. It was my privilege to lead worship for that. And it was amazing to see, you know, so many people who don't know God in that room. It was a terrific, it was just one of those meetings where you just thought, and the four stories that they gave was amazing. So that's the great news. That's been terrific. We also have faced, not necessarily that you need to know this, but in the last year we faced lots of challenges, pastoral challenges, stuff that I've certainly never come across, that's really made us think, who are we and how are we going to go through this? And as of last Tuesday, 5 days ago, we found out that the venue that we normally meet on a Sunday, the school, is not going to let us meet there anymore as of the 1st of April. The rest of the church doesn't know that yet, so if you could keep it under your hats or just keep it to yourselves. But, you know, that's an opportunity, but it's also potentially an issue. And so I've just sensed, I think I've grown in faith, actually, as I've seen issues come up and seen God actually help us to work through them. And so I just thought I'd bring that to you just so that you kind of know something of where we're at. Biblically, we're looking at Luke chapter 1, and Luke chapter 1 comes after, as you may know, 400 years of essentially a biblical blackout. If I say the phrase to you, the winter is nearly over, anybody think of a film that comes out of? Narnia, yes. C.S. Lewis typically captures this image so powerfully. I don't know if you've seen The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, but there's this idea of things just freezing over. It's freezing. Everything's freezing. And then there's this statement, the winter is nearly over. And then the sun begins to shine. Do you remember that? Have you remembered? It's been months, I know. But and that frozen river begins to thaw out. And it's just a terrific image, isn't it, of the what sun can do and light can do. And, you know, I use that image because at the end of the reading that we just had, it talks about the sun. It literally says, by which the rising sun will come to us from heaven to shine on those living in darkness in the shadow of death. So the image I'm hoping to leave you with, just one image this morning, is that of dawn, of the sun penetrating what felt like darkness that couldn't be overcome. I don't know if you've been in a place where it's so dark that even when you light a torch, it only barely lights up the tiny little bit that the beam falls on. But there's that oppressive darkness which feels like nothing can lift it. Even the streetlights battle to try to, you know, keep some sort of reminder of what light looks like. But really, it's a losing battle. The dark, you can almost feel it oppressing you, heavier, heavier. And what's amazing about darkness, it is simply the absence of light. When the sun begins to dawn, this darkness suddenly becomes scarce and you begin to think, what was that all about? Just like that heavy, cold mist that can kind of penetrate into your bones. And when the heat of the sun's rays begins to warm you up, the mist just has to evaporate. There's no power in darkness. It is the absence of light, essentially. And biblically speaking, this is what's happening here. So what I wanted to do was just chart briefly this story of how light dawned in Luke chapter 1. And obviously bring that into our own lives with how light is dawning in our own lives. The story Luke starts off with is with this introducing this man called Zechariah. Zechariah was a priest, And his wife was also from the priestly background. Verse 5 I'm starting in. I won't have time to read it. But Zechariah is at a very important week of his life. He's a priest in the temple there in Jerusalem. But he's been allotted for 1 week to be the one who burns the incense in the center of this temple. Many of the priests would never get that chance. It was just allotted by random to different people. And he was at this place. So there he is by the altar. And that's when the angel appears to him. There's three things we find out about Zechariah and his wife. True of both of them. They're both of a priestly background. They're both described as blameless and upright. And they're both suffering from the disgrace of being barren. So it's like the darkness, like the heavy mist that actually seeped into their lives too. Yes, they were upright. Yes, he was a priest. Yes, he was in the one climax week of his life. And yes, this disgrace hung over him and his wife's heads. And if you don't think if you think disgrace is a bit strong, verse 25, that's exactly the words that Elizabeth, his wife, uses. The Lord has lifted the disgrace. Not just that they longed for kids, not just that they'd love to have kids like everybody else is having kids, but this sense that actually if you don't have kids, something was wrong. That disgrace heavily weighed on them. And so this angel appears. And in a nutshell, the dawn is going to come through a baby. Actually, two babies. And you know, as I've been a parent, I've realized actually this is... Children do bring a lot into our lives. If there's one thing children bring, it's change. And for those who really don't want to change and they have children, they have to think of lots of ways to get around it because essentially children demand change in us. They slow our pace down. As parents, you'll know this. I'm there with Kyra Joy. She's just got Velcro shoes and she loves to do them herself. And I'm thinking, man, we got to be there. And you're fiddling around with this Velcro. You know, they just love that, don't they? They just force you to change the pace of your life. Or they should force us to do that. They teach us how to love sacrificially. You come back from work, all you want to do is relax and have some space. But your child needs to come first. And as you grit your teeth and put them first, you realize they can take you to a new place that TV couldn't. They teach you the value and importance of discipleship, don't they? Don't you wish children would do what you say and not just what you do? This is so challenging. Why is it my 3-year-old is absorbing my behavior and the way that I react, the way that I look, all these different things which I don't like about myself? Why can't they just do what I say? Why is it that children before the age of 7 are programmed such that they learn more in those first 7 years than they'll learn for the rest of their lives, irrespective of how many PhDs they might get? How is it that these children are so programmed to bring change and newness into our lives? And certainly in this culture, we struggle to give them the space to do that. But anyway, I think what I'm trying to say is that the idea of these two babies being the dawning of the new age actually makes some sense to me. And Zechariah and Elizabeth were thrilled. Let's just capture the essence of it. Verse 13, if you can read with me with this. Of chapter 1. The angel said to Zechariah. So he appears by Zechariah. Zechariah is terrified. Always the case with angels. They're scary looking things. The angel says, "Do not be afraid, Zechariah. Your prayer has been heard." Wow. It's partly thanks to Zechariah, maybe, that this is all happening. "Your wife Elizabeth will bear you a son. You're to give him the name John. He will be a joy and a delight to you." That's the exact reason, the promise that we had for our daughter, by the way. That's why we called her Kyra Joy. It's a terrific thing. And many will rejoice because of his birth. He will be great in the sight of the Lord. He's never to take wine or fermented drink. He will be filled with the Spirit even from birth. Many of the people of Israel will he bring back to the Lord their God. He will go on before the Lord in spirit and power of Elijah to turn the hearts of the fathers to their children and the disobedient to the wisdom of the righteous. Do you see God's concerns seeping through Gabriel's message there? These are values that God has. Turning fathers' hearts back to their children to make ready a people prepared for the Lord. And Zechariah at that point fell on the ground in worship and adoration, saying, God, the dawn is finally coming. 400 years of blackout, and now you're doing something. Only he doesn't, does he? Did you read the next verse? Verse 18. Zechariah said to the angel, how can I be sure of this? Do you know, every time God seems to work or appear to us, he creates that space for faith. Have you ever noticed that? To Abraham, he literally appeared to Abraham. But then he gave it 25 years before Isaac actually was born. He creates this vision. Guys, I'm going to do a new thing. And you're like, yes! And you realize to get that new thing, you have to step into the unknown. To be able to reach out to his hand, you have to have got out of the boat. God so honors us. He's so... faith is such a powerful thing to bring us back to God that he's never going to just do something magically in our lives without us requiring faith to step into that. I'm slightly laboring this point because when I come to the point of challenging you, you're going to need faith. So the angel, verse 19, says, I am Gabriel, I stand in the presence of God, and I have been sent to speak to you and to tell you this good news. And now you will be silent and you will not be able to speak. Immediately there's implications for Zechariah's lack of faith. And if you think Gabriel here is just punishing Zechariah because maybe he's fed up with Zechariah's lack of faith, then let's just wait. Because actually, the next part of the story shows what God is actually doing in all this. So let's rush on. The dawn is beginning to dawn, if you can say that. And we're on to verse 57 at this point. Verse 57. This is obviously at least 9 months later. Elizabeth did indeed get pregnant, despite her age and her barrenness, and now is the point where she's about to give birth. Verse 57, when it was time for Elizabeth to have her baby, she gave birth to a son. Her neighbors and relatives heard that the Lord had shown her great mercy, and they shared her joy. On the eighth day, presumably they're at the temple at this point, and we're not sure exactly who they is, it doesn't matter, probably a bunch of men, came to circumcise the child. And they were going to name him after his father Zechariah, which makes a lot of sense. That's the way it was done. But his mother spoke up. Now, she's not given the microphone at this point. The men are deciding what this baby's going to be called. They're just about to name him Zechariah and circumcise him. But Elizabeth knows that this baby is from God. She knows this is God removing her disgrace. And she somehow breaks through the group and grabs the microphone and says, his name will be John. And nobody believes her. Verse 61, they said to her, there's no one among your relatives who has that name. And then they made signs to his father. Now this is interesting. This is easy to skip over this bit. Why did they make signs to this man? Zechariah cannot speak. But there's no indication that he can't hear. So why sign language to Zechariah? Presumably he can hear, he just can't speak. And it's almost like, in the way that Zechariah struggled to believe the angel Gabriel, and in struggling to step out in faith, the angel said, okay, you're not going to be able to speak for a while. So these people who think this is just another wonderful birth don't realize the miracle that is dawning. They don't step out in faith. And they can't speak. And so they sign to Zechariah, what shall we name him? And so Zechariah is given the stage. He's the one now in control. Except that he can't speak either. It's almost like God's in this in every single way. It's almost like God saying, you know, you guys are so quick to get on with your everyday life, to go through your normal traditions. I'm trying to break in here. This is the dawning of a new age, not just the birth of a baby. And so Luke slows the pace right down. Right down. Did you get that? Good. Okay, one or two of you did. Zechariah has to write down the name of this son. And he gets this tablet, and you can almost imagine, everybody's like, wow, what's he going to write? What's he going to write? His name is... Maybe he had to rub out that bit then because he had run out of slate and he turned it over. John. And immediately his mouth is opened. His tongue is loosed. And he began to speak. And he began to praise God. The dawn is starting to come. Rays of sunshine are starting to break through. Hope is beginning to ripple out. Now Zechariah doesn't just speak. Look at the impact it has. Verse 65. The neighbors were filled with awe throughout the hill country of Judea. People were talking about these things. Everyone who heard this wondered about it, asking, what then is this child going to be? For the Lord's hand was with him. You see, in Gabriel stopping up the mouth of Zechariah, it's almost like when you stop up a river. And it builds and it builds and it builds and it builds. And boof, when the dam is opened, there's such a rage of revelation that people take note. And look at what Zechariah does. He does something that's been very rare for 400 years. He prophesies. And listen to this. Verse 67. Zechariah is filled with the Holy Spirit and prophesied, praise to the Lord, the God of Israel. He has come and has redeemed his people. He has raised up a strength of salvation for us in the house of his servant David. As has said through the prophets long ago, salvation from our enemies, from the hand of all who hate us, to show mercy to our fathers, to remember his holy covenant, the oath he swore to our father Abraham, to rescue us from the hand of our enemies, to enable us to serve him without fear in holiness and righteousness before him all our days. Zechariah launches into this terrific Benedictus, this terrific song. You see what the situation was. Israel was enslaved. Why were they enslaved? Because they wouldn't fully trust God. They began to compromise. They wandered off the path of trusting that God would meet their every need. They started looking for immediate gratification, immediate solutions. But as they did that, their faith in the one true God was eroded. Now listen, I know this prophecy is primarily about Christ. I know it is about salvation dawning. I know that Christ is the one who fulfilled this. But I just wanted to look at ripples of light that might affect us a little bit. Because although Jesus is the light of the world, we've sung that this morning. Do you know who Jesus said was the light of the world? You. Can you imagine that? Matthew 5, you are the light of the world. Hang on, it's meant to be Jesus. I don't mind promoting Jesus and telling people they really ought to look to Jesus. But sure as heck, I don't want people looking at my life. You're the light of the world. I'm going to be going soon. And until I come back again in that glorious ultimate light, you're it. We've just heard about a carol service, an obvious way to try to seek to be light. Let me just tell you something which is slightly less obvious. A way to be light in our workplace. I lead a group called the Mustard Seeds, and it's a bunch of people who are trying to find God, and they're pretty much halfway there. On Wednesday night, I was there with a guy called Simon. Simon said, who works for BT, he said the pressure is so much. There's so, you know, he's not being recognized for what he's doing, and the pressure is just so much that the other day, and this is quite troubling, he went down the stairs at work and he hit his own head so hard with his hands that he knocked himself out. When he came round, he asked to leave work and admitted himself to the GP. And do you know what Simon's prayer was on that night? He's just learning to pray. His prayer was that he would be strong enough to kind of cope with the pressure. to somehow not blow it. And I gently challenged him. I said, do you know what? What if you prayed for more? What if you prayed that God's will in heaven, yeah, this is the Lord's Prayer, would be done in BT as it's done on in heaven? What if you prayed that God, the judge of all things, who can make wrong into right, who can shine his light to either challenge people to change their lives or somehow get them out of that job? What if you prayed that that God would begin to shine his light into the actual management of BT? Well, he said, oh, I wouldn't want to, I don't want to judge people at BT. I don't think it's my place to judge them. And I said, actually, you know what? You're not meant to judge them. The point of this prayer is that God judges them. And we're not asking God in his light and holiness to begin to shine his light into the places where we work, into the schools where we work, into the families that we're trying to bring up. Ask his light to be shining, that his will, just as it's done perfectly in heaven, no doubt, that would begin to be done on this earth. That people who are getting in the way of that, who are destroying other people's lives for the sake of profit, for example, that light would shine in their lives and that they would actually be changed. That either their hearts would be changed or their positions would be changed and they would be moved out of those situations. I mean, I don't know, but is that what it's like to be light in this world, to be the people who are calling down God's power? Not just asking God's strength to be able to sustain ourselves through this massive pressure, but actually asking God to change things. Do you know, that means that a caretaker in a primary school can have more impact on the head teacher than even the vice principal or whatever. Because they're asking God's power to get involved and to either change that head teacher's heart or get them out of that position. To begin to bring God's will done in heaven, to be see it done in, on earth. I don't know, maybe that's something you need to think about in your home groups. Maybe you don't feel that's right. To be honest, sometimes I rather just stir up people's thoughts than say the predictable. And I hope that hasn't offended anybody. But I just think sometimes we're maybe missing a trick. Maybe when God said in Genesis 12 that those you bless will be blessed and those you curse will be cursed. Maybe when Jesus turned around to the disciples and said, you are the light of the world. You are the salt of the earth. He meant that he wanted us to have a life-changing impact on this world. Not just through what we say, not just through how well we live out Jesus Christ visually, but through praying that God's light would shine in our lives and in the lives of people who don't know him. Finally, I want to just end with verses 76 onwards. Zechariah has been giving this prophecy, and it's almost as though he at this point looks down at the baby in his arms. And you, my child, verse 76, will be called a prophet of the Most High. You will go on before the Lord to prepare the way for him, to give the people, his people, the knowledge of salvation through the forgiveness of their sins. Do you know, it's not just that out there is darkness, is there? It's not just that the BT management or the NHS management or whoever else are the people who are pressurizing our lives. Much of what we suffer is what we allow into our own lives, ourselves. Forgiveness. Is the only way back. Forgiveness is the only way that we can begin to be unentangled with the things that so easily enslave us. The way we've compromised our lives. The relationships we've got into, which we realize are now actually hindering us from following God. The decisions we've made at work, which we now think, oh Lord, how do we possibly be a light now? How can I share that I know God when I've done that. Forgiveness washes white as snow. Where do you feel trapped? Literally, has anything sprung to mind when I ask you the question, where do you feel trapped in life? What springs to mind? Christ is here to set us free. The winter is nearly over. In fact, it is over. Christ has started a new era. An era where light can reign. But the ripples of it are still working themselves out. And we have a choice. In light of this vision, in light of what Gabriel said to Zechariah, will we say, how can I be sure of this? How can I be sure that anything can change in my workplace? How can I be sure that I could possibly be a light? How can I be sure that that thing which I've admitted to nobody could be forgiven? Well, as children of God, we stand in the presence of God. And we declare to one another that this is true. And we must step out. And if we've struggled to believe in the past, then my prayer is like Zechariah, as our life has been dammed up for a certain period of time, that God, as we respond in faith and obedience, would break that dam. And the river of God's blessing would flow through us and into others in a way that never could have. Let's pray.